Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The Labor Department reported the January unemployment rate dropped to 9.7% in January. Yesterday, President Obama called for high-level talks with Republicans to work out a compromise on health care legislation. On the same day, Scott Brown of Massachusetts became the Senate's 41st Republican. And the Department of Transportation opened a new investigation into problems with the 2010 Toyota Prius. Joining me for this week's Friday News Roundup, Matthew Continetti of the Weekly Standard, Cheryl Gay-Stolberg of the New York Times, and Chris Hayes of The Nation. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Remember, you can also join us on Facebook and Twitter. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Good news on the jobs front, Cheryl.
Good news, but not great news. A 9.7% unemployment rate is really nothing to write home about. And we know that in certain sectors of American society, for instance, in the African-American community, the unemployment rate is in fact higher. So while it's trending in the right direction, I suppose down from about 10%, we don't know if the trend will continue. And really, a lot of people in this country are still hurting, and so I don't expect it to change much, the talk about stimulus or job creation that we've been hearing lately from the president and members of Congress.
Okay, that's the cup half empty, but we're down from double digits. Chris Hayes.
Well, if I'm in the role of the cup half full, I would say that when the president took over, we were looking at 700,000 jobs a month being lost. I mean, it was a catastrophic kind of plummeting quality. And that's a big difference, 700,000 to 20,000. I mean, I think the argument that the administration is making, and I myself have been a critic of it, but the argument they're making is that we have arrested the plummeting. We are sort of nearing the bottom, and we're going to sort of start edging up. And the fact that the unemployment number is declining indicates that that might be the case. Now, the problem is, over the long term, what is the slope of that increase in jobs going to look like? And what we've seen over the last several recessions, quite worryingly for this administration, is that that has been a very gradual slope.
Right.
It's taken a long time
right.
for jobs to come back.
Right. And Matthew Continetti, what's your take?
Well, I think short term, politically, this helps the president. I think not only this, but also we've seen a short uptick in his approval numbers, back to around 50%. So the landscape politically is shifting back short-term in the president's favor. And, of course, fundamentally, in political terms, as long as the number is going down, then the White House is unfurling its Morning in America banners for 2012. Even though Reagan ran on re-election in 1984 with unemployment higher right. than it was when he came into office, it had still decreased enough from its peak in 1982 for him to declare mourning in America.
And all told, we have to agree with you, Cheryl, there are 8.4 million jobs that have been eliminated from the workplace.
That's right. And, if we're talking politically, 2012 was one thing, but we've got a midterm election coming up
Absolutely.
In 2010, and we're not going to see much change in that picture this year. And that's going to make for a very difficult political climate for the president in keeping Democrats in control of Congress, which, of course, is his goal.
Chris Hayes, there's been so much in the news about Toyota this week with the president on this morning, Akio Toyoda apologizing for these massive global recalls. You have to wonder also about the U.S. government, NHTSA, its role, what's going on.
Well, there's been a sort of slow motion car wreck, to use the metaphor, in how Toyota has handled the quality control on these vehicles. Last year, they thought it was a floor mat problem. It clearly became clear it was a pedal problem. And then just when it seemed like they were getting through the recall on the pedals, then the Prius 2010 brake system has now come under scrutiny.
But in addition to the brake pedals, in addition to the floor accelerator pedals, there is now some indication there could be an electronic problem going on here, Matt.
Absolutely. And Congress is going to stick its head into the mess with two hearings in the House in the coming weeks. Ray LaHood, a man who admitted to the New York Times several months ago that he was not an expert in transportation issues. But nonetheless, the Secretary of Transportation has actually done an interesting thing over the past few months, which is he's recast his role as kind of a consumer advocate. And so this is, I think, a plus for the administration. However, behind the larger backdrop here is that all of this mess is taking place while the government owns General Motors and financed the bailout of Chrysler. And conservatives are attacking this as saying, look, you have a conflict of interest here. Now, I disagree with them. This is a mess, and the government should probably see what's going wrong.
What do you mean a conflict of interest?
Well, because when Ray LaHood said, stop driving it, and obviously sales of Toyota are plummeting at a time when who stands to benefit? Well, the federal government, because they own General Motors. Now, as I said, I disagree with this conservative critique. Nonetheless, to me, it's just one more reminder that the government needs to exit the auto industry.
Ray LaHood immediately backed off that statement, Cheryl.
Well, he knew instantly that it was a big blooper. You know, Ray LaHood was a congressman from Illinois, a Republican, by the way, very plain-spoken, a guy from Peoria who, frankly, talks like a guy from Peoria. And a lot of people actually like that about him. And, you know, I think he probably said what a lot of people were thinking, which is stop driving it, and quickly followed by take it to the dealer.
Of course.
But, of course, those three words, stop driving it, stuck. Toyota's stock you know, took a nosedive, and a lot of nervousness around that. And he quickly realized he had made a mistake and backtracked. But I think the bigger issue for the federal government is, where were the regulators? We've had a lot of discussion about what did Toyota know and when did they know it. But I think quickly the conversation will turn to what did federal regulators know and when did they know it?
And what do we know about that, Cheryl?
Well, I think we know that they saw some signs early on. Last year, I think, as we've said, we'll see more in these congressional hearings coming up. There'll be a lot of questions asked, and I think we'll find out a much fuller picture about what they knew.
I think what gets me is that there have been reports that consumers reported to NHTSA, reported to Toyota, and those reports were basically ignored.
Right. Just as reports of Bernie Madoff were ignored by the SEC. I mean, tales of regulatory failure are not in short supply these days. But I'd say, look, I mean, the market is going to work here. I mean, this is a disaster for Toyota. It affects 9 million cars on three different continents. It affects the most important car out today, which is the Prius, and which is supposed to be the car of the future. And consumers are not going to buy these cars if they don't know what they're getting.
Here's an email from Vicky. She says, why is the media piling on Toyota when they've had such a great quality record? Ford, GM, Chrysler have had numerous recalls. Yep. Toyota has had so few. We need perspective in this story of Toyota recalls, Chris.
Well, it's funny, actually, because I was looking at some of the clippings on the brake issue on the Prius, and they sort of mentioned in one little paragraph, actually, the Ford hybrid's been having some brake problems, too, and it has to do when it switches between these two braking systems. There's this moment of where it feels like the car isn't braking. I think the reason that the media is, quote, piling on is because it's a classic man-bites-dog story, precisely because the entirety of the Toyota brand identity for two decades has been quality and reliability. And in fact, so much so that American car companies were sending their executives over to Japan to study the way that Toyota made cars.
If that hideous accident had not occurred, where we heard the state trooper screaming, "We need help. I cannot stop this car." If we had not heard that, and if those four people had not died, perhaps there wouldn't be this kind of piling on. Cheryl.
I agree. I think that clearly added to the outrage and the horror of it all. Although I do think that if we had gotten all of these reports, that it is frankly shocking. Toyota is a brand that has been trusted for years by Americans. And that is really why the media is piling on, because it's a surprise. You might expect this from the beleaguered and struggling American auto industry, but we didn't expect it from the Japanese.
And of course, this is not helping the Japanese economy either, Matt.
Right. At a moment when the Japanese economy, like the American, needs all the help it can get. But I disagree with my colleagues slightly. Obviously, the surprise is one reason the press is covering this, but I also think it's the scope. This is amazing. All of the models that this affects, all of the cars. Again, I said three continents already. I think that's what makes this a major story, and that's why government and politicians are so interested in it.
Does any of you own a Toyota?
No.
Nope.
I do.
That's why we're interested.
Welcome back to Toyota Talk.
Absolutely. I have a 2002 Toyota, and it's been a great car. Never had any problem with it. It was made in Kentucky because there is some indication that those cars made in Japan have not had the same problem.
Right, and we often forget we call Toyota a Japanese company, but of course they have many, many factories in the United States and employ American workers. Now, it's always been kind of an enemy of the UAW union because those workers are not unionized.
Matthew Continetti of the Weekly Standard, Cheryl Gaystolberg of the New York Times, Chris Hayes, he's Washington editor of The Nation and a fellow at the New America Foundation. We'll take a short break. Your calls when we come back. Stay with us. Welcome back. Three reporters are with me for the domestic portion of our Friday News Roundup. Cheryl Gaystolberg of the New York Times, Chris Hayes of The Nation, Matthew Continetti of the Weekly Standard. He edits that magazine's Campaign Standard blog. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Here's an email from Donnie on the Toyota issue. Why did it take such a significant safety concern for the mainstream media to finally examine Toyota with the same scrutiny it has done with American automobile manufacturers? Fair question, Chris?
Maybe it's a fair question. I mean, I do think that part of the reason that there wasn't a lot of scrutiny of Toyota was because objectively it really did have a very good safety record. So I don't think there was any kind of cover-up. Although I will say that when the reports began to emerge last year, it's possible that both regulators and the press were slow to pick up on it precisely because they had these preconceptions about Toyota's quality.
Matt?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with Chris. You know, we often tie ourselves to narratives in the media, and if the narrative is Japanese quality, quote-unquote, then we're going to overlook stories that contradict that narrative. narrative.
All right, we saw a rather special television production this week when President Obama met with members of the Republican Party. It was totally televised beginning to end. Matt, what do you think of it?
Well, like I think most people, I enjoyed it immensely, and I thought it was a win-win. I thought it was a win for the president. After a few hard weeks, he was able to continue his move slowly to the center. He was able to demonstrate that he wants to cooperate, or at least wants to listen to Republicans. And it was a win for, and it also showcased, of course, his strongest qualities, which are debate and civil dialogue. But it was also a win for the Republicans. For one, the president acknowledged that Republicans do have ideas, something that he rarely does. And two, it elevated really a backbench Republican figure, the congressman from Wisconsin, Paul Ryan, who has a real vision to correct and address America's budgetary problems. It elevated him to presidential sparring partner level. And I think that was good not only for Ryan because it elevated his national profile, but also for Republicans because it shows that they have a solution to these problems.
Chris.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I agree with Matt, and I agree with all the people that I found it tremendously gripping television. I think like a lot of people did. I think it's interesting to note Paul Ryan, who the president did spend a lot of time talking with, put out a budget this week, an alternative vision to how to get the country back on fiscal track. And, you know, I was really gratified that he put it out there. And the vision is quite stark. It involves essentially phasing out Medicare, as we know it, privatizing Social Security, cutting heavily into discretionary non-defense spending. And all of this achieves a budget surplus in 50 years. So the vision is being put out there, and I commend Paul Ryan for putting out there, but I actually think Democrats should go to every town meeting across this land with the Paul Ryan budget and say, look, this is what the opposition party wants, and is this what you want?
Cheryl.
You know, I thought beyond the optics of it, the imagery and the politics of who won and who lost, I actually thought it was deeply important that they do this. I viewed it almost as kind of a marriage therapy session. You know, the president and members of Congress, Republicans and Democrats, have to work together. They have a relationship. And feelings had gotten so raw and so frayed that I think it was very important that they come together in an honest way and show the American people that they can talk civilly about ideas and the future of the country.
Do they want to do it again? That's the question.
I think that is the question. And the question is, how often can they televise these things? You only get that kind of pop once. You can't. And they do have fundamentally different ideas about how to take the country, different policy prescriptions for what will work. But, you know, the president has said he wants to invite the leadership in on a monthly basis, bipartisan, Republicans and Democrats. I think they're going to do that very soon. And so we'll see.
And it's interesting that David Corn and Grover Norquist, who do not agree on very much, have really, really urged with their proposal that they meet regularly. Matt.
That's true. The White House downplayed this call from David and others to institutionalize these events. They said that if you did that, it would rob it of its spontaneity. And I happen to agree with the White House on this issue. I think one reason the event was a success was that it was unscripted, that no one really knew what it was going to look like. And if you made this a regular thing, before you knew it, there'd be a commission on presidential question time, delegating rules and specifying, you know, how high the podium had to be for each side and whatnot. So it would rob it of its spontaneity. I'd also say all the incentives were right for cooperation. Rather, you know, you had a president who is still rather popular, so Republicans are going to be polite to him. And you also had a president who wants to reach out to the other side and show after the Massachusetts election that he can cooperate. So he was polite.
Did Republicans make a mistake by agreeing to televise this, Chris?
You know, I don't know. I think I sort of agree with Matt. I mean, I think certain Republicans ended up looking good. I think ultimately it's very difficult. I mean, Frank Lutz said this afterwards. You know, he's the president's the one up on the podium. And the other thing is that Barack Obama is, for all his flaws, which we've seen quite a few of, is just a tremendously impressive figure in those kinds of environments. He's obviously very knowledgeable about the policy. He's very sort of graceful. And I thought actually the best thing about it from the White House's perspective was that you could see him getting angry sometimes and channeling that a little bit. I mean, there was a few times when he said things and there was kind of boos and hissings. And he said, now, hold on a second. And I like the marriage therapy analogy for that reason, because there was a certain kind of rawness to it. I mean, you could see him losing his kind of total reserved calm at moments. And I thought it was actually salutary.
And of course, then he met with Democrats, Cheryl.
Right. And his tone was a little different with Democrats. And he needs Democrats to have a little spine, right? He wants to buck them up. As he said in the State of the Union, you know, don't run for the hills. And so so that was his message to the Democrats, which is don't abandon me on health care. Don't go weak-kneed on me. He wants them to get going. Now, whether he's going to get them going is another matter.
The Democratic meeting wasn't quite as exciting as the Republican one. It's hard to make good television when both sides agree with each other. But I would just say this. For everyone calling to institutionalize these meetings, just imagine for a moment what they would look like with a different president, President Bush, say, with 30% approval ratings and a hostile Democratic Congress. I think it would have been much more contentious. And for me personally, one you lie is enough.
Well, one you lie, I sure hope we put behind us and do not hear a second. President Obama did talk with Democrats just as Scott Brown was being sworn in, trying to move them really beyond their defeat, Chris.
Well, this is interesting and frustrating. In the State of the Union, he said, "Don't run for the hills." He said in the addressing the Senate Democratic Caucus, "Buck up." But behind the scenes, if the reporting I've been doing on the Hill and the reporting others are doing, the White House has not been pushing very hard behind the scenes on health care. In fact, there's a report today that Al Franken basically confronted David Axelrod in the behind the sort of closed door session of that same meeting, saying, "Where are you guys? Show some leadership." This is if the Democrats do not pass this health care bill, it will be one of the most feckless, disastrous implosions of political will. In decades.
So are you suggesting they ought to move forward with some sort of reconciliation?
Absolutely. There's no question. Look, Ben Nelson, who is talking about first of all, let's be clear about what reconciliation is. A, it's majority rule. B, it is not the footsteps of tyranny approaching. I mean, Bush passed two tax cuts with it. Tax cuts that, I hasten to add, Ben Nelson himself voted for. He did not have a procedural objection at that moment. And so they have gone all this way. They've, as Max Bach has said, they've paid for lunch. They might as well eat it. And there are millions of people out there right now who don't have health insurance. I know it's very easy to get caught up in the process, but the fact of the matter is there are 30 million people out there with no health insurance who stand to benefit from this.
I think their thinking is we've got to do jobs right away. I mean, yes, health care is important, but the clear message of Massachusetts and, frankly, the message that they're getting from around the country, from lawmakers, even before the Massachusetts election was you've got to focus on jobs. So until they get some kind of bill passed, I don't envision them going back to healthcare. And frankly, I think there are serious doubts within the White House and the Democratic leadership about whether they can, in fact, rustle up the votes for reconciliation.
Right. That's the problem. That's healthcare's problem. It's not lack of will among liberals. It's a number, 218. It's the number of votes Nancy Pelosi needs to pass the Senate bill in the House. And she doesn't have the votes now. Just the AP reported just yesterday that two members of her own delegation, two California Democrats, broke out in laughter when a reporter asked them what the status of health care was. Then you have the fact that there's this Mexican standoff going on between Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi. Pelosi says, no, we're not going to move until the Senate passes the fixes to the Senate bill, which was passed in December. Harry Reid says, no, we're not going to move until Pelosi passes the Senate bill, and then we can make the fixes. And I don't think this Mexican standoff will be resolved before the election.
In terms of, in terms of will, all I was saying is that there is a procedural way forward. I mean, can she get the 218 votes? I think if the Senate does move on reconciliation, she can get the 218 votes. That's what my reporting suggests. But again, this is up in the air. I think what's also really interesting, which I think has gone completely unremarked this week, when Scott Brown was elected, there was all this conversation, we will not have any big controversial votes until he's seated. And there's been two controversial votes. There's a vote to raise the debt ceiling, right? Which, funnily enough, Scott Brown did not race to Washington to vote for. And there was a vote to confirm Ben Bernanke. And there was no outcry. I mean, I found this fascinating. This was actually quite a controversial vote to confirm Bernanke. He was confirmed with less votes than any Federal Reserve chairman in history. And there was not a single person who raised a peep about the fact that this proceeded with the incumbent Senator Kirk.
Because how many Americans do you think are really watching the votes on Ben Bernanke, whose name most of them can't even pronounce, and the debt ceiling, which they don't understand? But they do understand health care because the president and congressional Democrats have been beating it into their heads all year long. So they could get away with having those votes. They could never get away with having a vote on health care without Scott Brown.
Now, I must tell you, Cheryl, that we've had an email from Chris in Peoria. He says, I live just up the road from Peoria. What does the guest mean? He speaks like someone from Peoria.
He speaks like a plain-spoken, ordinary American
person
who average people can connect with.
Cheryl Gay Stolberg of The New York Times, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We've got tons of callers. We'll open the phones, 800-433-8850. First to Gary, Indiana. Good morning, Jay. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi. How do you do? Love your show, Diane.
Thank you.
Hello to Cheryl, Matt, and Chris as well.
Hey. Hello.
Hi.
I wanted to, mention about the Toyota thing and then maybe touch a little bit on the Obama thing. But, I think Toyota's doing a really good job of what they're doing. I mean, despite, all of the controversy behind, all of this, you can raise questions, but the bottom line is we all know we're in a instant text blog and tweet era. I'm old enough to remember back in the day when the Ford Pinto had major fuel tank problems, being positioned too close to the rear bumper, getting rear-ended and catching on fire, and families burning up in a fire.
I too remember that.
To me, that was more gruesome as a young man growing up than any, accident of four people, careening off of a, off of a,
I don't think there's a comparison, really.
And don't get me wrong. I totally,
okay, so tell me what your point is.
Well, my point is that's just it, is that I think they're being hit a little too hard with the now information. In fact, that they are, trying to do all they can. I mean, you can only do, when you have that many vehicles on the road, there's only so much you can only get them in so fast.
What strikes me about the caller's point is how things change. And history has changed over time. And Toyota has this reputation for being quality and safe. And now that reputation is lying in tatters. Whereas Ford, which had the reputation of the Pinto, is now posting record profits and really coming into its own.
You never know.
You never know.
All right, let's go to Ian in Tallahassee, Florida, or is it Ian?
It's Ian.
Okay.
And I would like to try to get the panel to focus off the micro to the macro. The incidents, the discussion on the State of the Union, the Republican Obama question and answer, and yesterday's prayer breakfast, the president all focused on the need for civility, that we're poisoning the well of the public debate. And as an election official, I can tell you, I sense this. I think we're at a critical juncture, and we need to discuss how we discuss our politics, or we will run into the problem that Benjamin Franklin mentioned a long time ago, that we ought not sacrifice our reason for ideology and substitute that instead of the political debate that we need to govern this nation.
I appreciate your call, Matt.
I slightly disagree with Ian. I actually think we have a robust democratic debate. I think we have ideologues, we have reporters who are being objective as they can be, and we do not lack for discussion in the United States. And of course, it could be more polite, but you know, the fact is, both sides traffic in sleazy attacks.
Polite is not quite the word; it's civil. And I think that the president has it right when he says we can disagree with one another, but we can only move forward if we try to find ways to discuss issues.
Yeah, that's true. But I think one of the things, I mean, I actually tend to fall with Matt on this. Civility is a good value. And, you don't like people yelling, "You lie," in the State of the Union, et cetera. You don't like accusations that the president was not born in the United States, yada, things like that. At the same time, there's a conception of politics in which civility is elevated, which views politics as essentially the reconciling of these different ideologies, and that people are going to kind of talk through their problems. And there's part of that, but there's also power. And power doesn't tend to reconcile itself. I mean, power gets only changed when it's forced to change.
But the American people may be saying, you guys better learn to work together, or this country is going to go downhill for lack of progress. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, more of your phone calls, your email. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, promoting lifelong family connections for children and youth, on the web at aecf.org. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. This is NPR.
The Friday News Roundup. China protests U.S. arms sales to Taiwan. India offers to resume talks with Pakistan. Behind the week's top international news, what happened and why, The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. An email from Maggie, who says, last night, Congress Daily reported that Senator Shelby of Alabama is holding every Obama nominee hostage to two earmarks for Alabama projects. Holds on nominees don't just require a 60-vote majority, which is hard enough to get. They take time that we are paying for and keep the government from working properly. Why isn't this getting more coverage in the press. Chris.
Well, I think this story should get more coverage because it embodies every single dysfunction of the Senate. You have this tradition of the hold, which allows one member of the Senate to essentially hold hostage any nominee. There has never, so far as congressional historians can ascertain, been a blanket hold in which Shelby has said, I now am putting any outstanding nominee I am holding hostage, I am putting a hold on. And what he wants in exchange, Republican, let's remember, Republican Richard Shelby, the party of small government, the party that hates federal spending and deficits, what he wants is for the United States federal government to make sure it spends more money in Alabama. He has a $45 million facility in Alabama to test IEDs that he wants built, and a $40 billion contract with Northrop Grumman, a lot of which would be built in Mobile, Alabama. This is pure hostage taking.
I'm stunned.
I haven't liked the hold since the Democrats used it to stop John Bolton from being reappointed ambassador to the United Nations, so I'm with Chris on this one. Next time there's a Republican president, I hope that the Democrats decide to live up to the rhetoric and not use the hold.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I couldn't agree with Matt more. And in fact, I think it's really important for magazines such as his and mine to be really consistent on this, because the dysfunctions of the Senate, they do affect both parties, and they are really grinding the government to a halt.
And in years past, you know, they used secret holds where a senator could put a hold on a nominee and wouldn't even have to identify himself or herself. That's gone by the boards, I think.
Let's talk for a moment about the first Tea Party convention that's going to take place this weekend in Nashville. Matthew, what do you expect?
Well, it's a big moment. And it's a big moment, one, because the Tea Party up to this point has been extremely diffuse and leaderless and unorganized. They're spontaneous. And I think that gives them strength. And they're also not necessarily associated with any particular party. There are many progressives who look at the Tea Party and see, potential Union Tea Party alliance on certain issues. This convention, I think, will start to change that. This convention will start to institutionalize the Tea Party, which could reduce its appeal. And it will also be, I think, an opportunity for a certain politician named Sarah Palin to launch a bid to lead the Tea Party, whether as part of the Republican Party or perhaps down the road as an independent third party. And I think that may also actually limit Palin's appeal as well.
And, of course, she is charging $100,000 for her appearance, but says that she will not benefit personally from that $100,000. I don't get that, Cheryl.
I guess she's going to give the money to charity. I don't know. But I the thing that I'm struck by the Tea Party convention is how it's in a way kind of fallen apart even before it started. Two of the lawmakers who are going to be there, Marsha Blackburn and Michelle Bachmann, pulled out. There's been rifts among the organizers. And I think, in a way, I actually find that kind of refreshing, because this is a nascent movement. It's not an organized movement. And that's these rifts and concerns among those about the way the convention has been pulled together speak to that.
But what is the relationship between the Republican Party and the Tea Party?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I mean, I want to push back a little on what Matt said. I do think there's elements of sort of populist discontent that I think people on the left can feel a certain solidarity with in the Tea Party movement. I applaud people that are angry and getting involved democratically generally. But let's be clear about the ideology of the Tea Partiers, so far as we know, is very extreme right wing. I mean, it is extremely conservative. If you went and talked to Tea Partiers, and I've interviewed some, but if you had any sort of empirical work about what their views are on evolution and what their views are on preemptive war and what their views are on civil liberties, I mean, you could go down the line and you would find it's a very right wing movement. That's what it is. So I think this idea that it's somehow independent of the two parties and it's occupying some new middle space is just not true.
Well, I think it's that the people who are involved in the Tea Party do not want to be co-opted by the Republican Party. They don't want to be operating in service of the Republican Party. They would see it as the other way around.
I think if you surveyed any Tea Party gathering, you would find people who were extremely upset with the Bush administration and the Republican Congresses, not only on the question of government spending and the prescription drug benefit, but right. also on the war in Iraq. I think many of these people look at big government foreign in terms of foreign policy as well as domestic policy. I disagree with them on the foreign policy side, but they are not slavish followers of the Republican Party.
All right. To Dave in Tulsa, Oklahoma. You're on the air. Dave.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm fine, thanks. Go right ahead.
The thing I want to bring up is I'm not really hearing a bunch about this, probably because it's not a very popular idea, since the insurance industry puts a lot of money into lobbying and campaign, et cetera. The biggest problem in America is not just greedy politicians. It's the fact that insurance controls everything. You can't do anything unless the insurance company tells you that you can. If we want this country to get back on track to where we are in control of it instead of some corporate entity behind the insurance companies, we have to make it not for profit. We have to make insurance not for profit, because it's so frustrating. I hate insurance.
All right, Dave, thanks for calling. Cheryl.
You know, I think the caller taps into a frustration that many Americans feel, and that, frankly, President Obama tried very hard to exploit in pursuing a health care overhaul, which is that he cast it as an issue of insurance reform, saying we need to rein in these bad insurance industry practices, like just denying coverage to people with pre-existing conditions. And that, in fact, is really the only popular element of his bill.
But
you can't do that without expanding coverage to all.
But isn't there next week going to be a discussion of removal of antitrust protection for the insurance companies?
That's right. Speaker Pelosi, seeing that for now and perhaps forever that the health bill stuck, is going to go on a dual track, and she's going to bring up this issue of removing the antitrust exemption from the insurance companies that I think is likely to pass the House, but I think has no chance in the Senate.
Well, it has no chance in the Senate because the Senate is a wholly owned subsidiary of the American insurance industry. The caller points to something, and I think Cheryl points to it too. People don't like health insurance companies. And one of the hilarious and tragic turns that this bill has taken is that in order to get the insurance companies on board, because they have so much political leverage, you had to give them so much that people got angrier and angrier with the process because they saw the process being sold out to those same special interests. And yet it would have been very hard to directly take them on. And so the legislation got caught in this awful vice between popular discontent with the insurance industry and the special interests and the fact that those same interests have so much legislative power in Washington.
And the fact is the president at the outset said he wasn't going to take them on. He took the single payer issue and put it off the table.
Yep.
And said, I'm not going to mess with the system that we have now.
Yep.
So I guess you might say he made his bed.
All right. Here's an email from Gail, who says, I'm the proud 60-year-old daughter of one of the original Tuskegee Airmen, the same narrow-minded, bigoted arguments used to keep blacks out of the military are being used to kick gays and lesbians out of the armed forces, depriving them of their freedom for the pursuit of happiness, depriving our country of their talents. There is no bad time to right a gross injustice. If the civil rights activities of the 50s, the activists of the 50s and 60s had waited for the right time, I would still be riding in the back of the bus. Enough of studies and polling. Stand up and do the right thing, America.
You know, it's good that the caller raised this, because this week we had a very, very important development. Admiral Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and Secretary Gates, head of the Pentagon, came out and said they were in favor of overturning Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the military policy that bars gays from openly serving. And this is very, very important. The president has said he wants to pursue repeal of the legislation. Now it's in Congress's hands, and we'll see what happens. It won't be easy to undo this policy, even with the leadership of Admiral Mullen and Secretary Gates.
Congress, as an institution, is not known for political courage. So what it looks like will happen is that the Pentagon is going to start repealing much of Don't Ask, Don't Tell on its own, making it harder to dispel and discharge servicemen because of their sexual orientation.
Here's an email from Gabriel. Mr. Continetti's comment that President Obama was willing to move toward the middle and was finally willing to listen to Republicans was outrageous. It implies the president wasn't doing this already. The president has been pursuing a middle ground, attempting to be bipartisan from the beginning. Republicans are the ones who are doing everything they can to stifle progress. There was this agreement that the Republicans had with the president and then backed away from this week, Matt.
That's right. And there were certain issues like the deficit commission, in which some of the Republicans in the Senate switched their votes. They had originally co-sponsored the Gregg legislation, but then they switched their votes and they brought it to an end because it didn't reach 60. Obviously, both sides are responsible. What I meant by that comment about President Obama is a change in tone and also a change in policy. The change in tone is he often last year invoked straw men, saying conservatives didn't want to do anything, which is just false. Conservatives have plenty of ideas. It's just that Obama disagreed with them. He never said that. And the change in policy is that he's lowered his sights. $100 billion for jobs is not a new foundation for the United States of America.
Chris.
I think it's important to hammer this point home about healthcare because, you know, one of the things that I thought the president wisely articulated in his meeting with the House Republicans, he said, look, this health care bill that you've been going around the country saying is socialism on the march and a Bolshevik plot, this is the plan that the closest it's most closely bears resemblance to the alternative plan that Bob Dole proposed back during the Clinton administration. And it most closely bears resemblance to the plan signed by the man who is almost the Republican nominee for president, Mitt Romney in Massachusetts. It is a center-right conservative plan, and yet, the goalposts keep getting moved. I personally would love single payer. I barely have – it's hard for me to even get that excited about this plan. It's so center-right. And yet, even though he's marched over on a policy – in a policy way, the Republicans continue to attack it as if it were – it literally were socialized medicine.
I think, unfortunately for the president, the Republicans are in a way winning that argument. People don't remember or recognize that he put single payer off the table. He took that off so easily that it wasn't a starting point for negotiations for him, so it doesn't look as if he's moved.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Stefan in Cincinnati, Ohio. Good morning to you.
Good morning. I just want to go over the point that the gentleman made about the Tea Party was upset with the Bush administration. They didn't form the Tea Party when he was in office. All of a sudden, when you ask them, why can you didn't do it when Bush was there? Oh, we were thinking about it. But you thought real quick when Obama got in office. So, you know, I don't buy all that. And as far as health care, you know what? If people don't see the light and they want to stick with the same old, then good. Just let the insurance company keep ripping you off.
Go ahead, Matt.
They didn't form the Tea Party when Bush was president, but they also didn't show up to the polls to vote for Republicans in 2006 and 2008. And it's this balance of enthusiasm that is now determining almost all of our politics. In 2006 and 2008, Republicans and Tea Partiers were dispirited. They stayed home while the left wing and the Democrats were energized and gave the Democrats the Congress and the presidency. Now it's swung the other way, and it's the Democrats who are demoralized and the Republicans and Tea Partiers who are enthused.
Cheryl.
You know, I think Matt's right. There were a lot of conservatives, fiscal conservatives, who were very angry with George Bush. Perhaps they didn't form a party, but when they passed that Medicare prescription drug benefit, a major expansion of federal powers, they were absolutely furious.
Yeah.
And Republicans, a lot of them who voted for it, held their noses when they did.
Go ahead, Chris.
I agree on that, although one thing that this massive blind spot that everyone seems to have who considers themselves a fiscal conservative is the fact that 60% of our discretionary spending is on the military and security and wars. And when we talk about wars, when we talk about the massive military-industrial complex, somehow that never enters into discussion. People call themselves fiscal conservative one moment, and the next moment they're hustling, like Richard Shelby is, for more military-industrial dollars into their state.
Right. Well, but of course, discretionary spending isn't really the problem with our long-term budget outlook. The problem is entitlements. And no one, neither party, has done anything to address that problem until the plan set forward by Ryan and the Democrats have attacked it.
Well, the problem long-term in our entitlements is the growth of healthcare spending. And actually, I think I'm pretty sure President Obama proposed a health care bill this year, which they've tried to push through with the aim of slowing the growth. I mean, this is all they talked about, bending the curve on the health care costs, precisely because this is – I was there at the first event in the White House. Peter Orszag, entitlement reform is health care reform. Medicare costs are being driven up by health care costs in general. If we don't get that under control, we are in a lot of trouble.
And important to note, Diane, that health care spending actually grew this year in an economy that was contracting. Healthcare spending amounted to 17.3% of the gross domestic product. Its share of the sector grew at the largest increase since 1960. So we know that these costs are growing, they are getting out of control, and if we don't do something about it, we're all in trouble.
One, that's not that surprising when you consider that the stimulus was heavily weighted toward healthcare, the healthcare sector and other social services. So the government's pumping a lot of money into that. And two, when it gets to the Obama healthcare bill, you're right, Chris, it was argued on these grounds of deficit reduction, but it relied on faulty assumptions to get there to where it would actually reduce the deficit.
And Matthew Continetti had the last word. He is with the Weekly Standard. Cheryl Gay Stolberg writes for the New York Times. Chris Hayes, he's Washington editor of The Nation. Thanks to all of you. Be careful of the snow. It has already begun. Have a peaceful, safe weekend, everybody. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.